This week, March 24th, 2015, on The Digital Story. Essential tools for event photography. Five additional things to do with a 50-megapixel camera. ACR 8.8 new camera support, but not Lightroom. All of this and more with yours truly, Derek Story, on The Digital Story. Welcome back to another Digital Story. I'm here from the studio in Santa Rosa. Boy, it has been a flurry lately. In fact, I'm a little bit late with this show today. I'm recording in the morning of Tuesday instead of Monday afternoon because, well, I went to a Warriors game last night. Actually, see, it's not all my fault here, because I worked the whole weekend shooting the Artisan Cheese Festival, which I'm going to talk a little bit about event photography today. So that'll be fun. We'll all benefit from that. But I worked through the whole weekend, and I went to a Warriors game on Saturday night, the Golden State Warriors NBA basketball. And then, they just finished up this homestand, six-game homestand, and they're just hotter than a pistol right now. So, you don't want to miss any of this. And I had been gone during all the other homestands. I was in Cuba and all that stuff. So really getting into the basketball thing right now. We went last night, and I got the podcast written, but I didn't quite get it recorded. And the one thing you don't want me to do is rush the podcast, right? You want a good podcast, a quality podcast, not something that I throw together right before I rush out the door, unless I have to. All right. So I have, it's morning. I have a bit of a morning voice, but I'm very alive and awake. I'm on my second mug of coffee here, and I have a great show for you today. So we'll start out with the weekly update, two very interesting posts there. Then we're going to get into event photography, and I have five tips, and these five tips they're solid. This is rock solid. This is stuff that I have tested over and over again, so I think you'll enjoy that. We're going to talk a little bit about additional things to do with a 50 megapixel camera. And of course, this is celebrating the release of the Canon 5DS and the 5DSR. So we're going to talk 50 megapixels here for a second. We've got a screening room and a little virtual camera club news. So great stuff. Let's get going. The weekly update. 10 new cameras supported by Adobe Camera Raw 8.8. That's right, Adobe Camera Raw 8.8. It's official, it's out, and we have some interesting new cameras supported by it, one of which I didn't even know existed. We'll get to that in a second. Here's the list of the new cameras that you can process their RAW files with ACR 8.8, and that's usually working in conjunction with either Bridge or Photoshop. Casio EX-ZR 3500, Canon EOS 750D or the Rebel T6i, the 760D or the T6s, Fujifilm 2 by Fujifilm, the X-A2 and the X-Q2, the Hasselblad Stellar 2. I had no idea that was out. That's a bad sign when you don't know that a camera is out and you find out in the RAW support tech notes. Nikon D5500, Olympus OMD EM5 Mark II, Panasonic Lumix DMC GF7, and the Panasonic ZS50. So that's a pretty interesting lineup there. What is also interesting is that Lightroom has not been updated. So if you want to process the RAW files from these cameras and you're an Adobe workflow type person, you will be working in either Bridge and Photoshop with ACR, but not Lightroom. What we'll probably see is that when Lightroom 6 comes out, which we don't know exactly when that's going to be, but I don't think it's too far away. When Lightroom 6 comes out, then this RAW support, I'll put a big stack of money on there. I don't have a big stack of money, but if I did, I would put it on that these cameras will be included in the support for Lightroom 6. Okay, in other news, now this is trippy. Ricoh's getting into the pixel shifting game here, and I'm going to read you a post from Imaging Resource. By the way, always the links in the show notes to anything here. So this is what Imaging Resource reports. Ricoh reveals pixel shifting high resolution mode coming soon to a camera near you? Unlike Olympus's approach, which grabs 8 frames and uses a half pixel shift, Ricoh's method uses just 4 shots to bring 4 pixels of each bare color filter array cell into alignment with each other. The resulting file has the same number of pixels as conventional shots, but each pixel contains full RGB data, sort of like what Sigma does with the Foveon sensor. So this is kind of cool, and according to this report, Ricoh was actually working on their pixel shifting before Olympus. Who knows if that's true or not? The fact of the matter is that both companies have been working on it. Olympus got theirs out. Ricoh's doesn't look like it's far behind. And what we're seeing is a side benefit of having sensor-based image stabilization. So instead of having just optical base where image stabilization happens in the lens, the little gyroscopes and stuff in the lens, compensates for camera movement. That's what Canon uses. That's what Nikon uses. That's what Panasonic uses most of the time. When you have sensor-based, such as Olympus and Pentax or Ricoh, then you can do other things with the sensor since you have such precise control of it. And pixel shifting seems to be one of the benefits that comes out of that. So I'm sure there's going to be more on the Ricoh front. But it's exciting because, I don't know if you caught it in the news, they've also officially announced their full-frame camera. So Ricoh / Pentax is going to have a full-frame sensor. And they're probably going to do pixel shifting with that sensor. So pretty exciting stuff if you're a Pentax shooter. I think 2015 is going to be a good year for you. And that is this week's Weekly Update. Story number one, essential tools for event photography. Whether you're getting ready to shoot a wedding, a trade show, or a birthday party, these tools will help you capture better images while increasing your enjoyment. And both parts of that are important. So let me explain these 5 tools, their tips, their techniques, they're a little bit of everything here. I shoot a lot of event photography. It's my passion. I came up through the newspaper business. I was a photojournalist for a long time because I would write the article and take the pictures. And I have learned some things over the years. And now when I go to shoot an event, I mean, back in the day when I was getting ready for a wedding or something like that, any sort of big event, I would be really nervous. I'd be really nervous, leading up to it and really concerned that I had all my ducks in a row, my equipment, all that sort of stuff. And in part, that's good because that helps you be focused, right? So there's nothing wrong with that at all. But these days, I'm far less nervous and far more confident because I really do have a system down that, I'll tell you, very, very, very seldom even plan A fails. And I always have a plan B and a plan C. But there are 5 things. If I distill all of that down into 5 things, when I cover most events these days, these are those 5 things. So let's start out. You're going, okay, Derek, get on with it. Enough with the intro. Number 1, a professional wide to moderate zoom. I just think this is so important. So I'm talking about the classic 24 to 70 millimeter f/2.8 zoom lens. Now, it can vary a little bit. It can be 24 to 80 or 28 to, 85, whatever happens to work for your particular camera mount. The part that I think is important, aside from that basic zoom range wide to a moderate tele is the constant f2.8 aperture, because that allows you to go into existing light mode when you need to, especially with the ISO performance that we have with cameras these days. If you have a quality lens that can shoot at f2.8 at any of its focal lengths, then you can switch over to ISO 1600 or ISO 1250 just on the fly and shoot existing light when it's appropriate, and then, you know, go back to fill flash if you need it. You just have a lot of versatility. The other thing that I like about the classic 24-70 professional zoom lens is that it's not too long. And I don't mean long in length, I mean long in reach and taking pictures. I like it because it forces the photographer to stay in contact with the subject. So you're not, you know, standing way back 30 feet, shooting shots. Now, yeah, there are times when, you know, that's appropriate. We're actually going to talk about a little bit longer lens here in a minute. But when you're shooting an event and the parts where you're immersed in the event and you're recording that, you're capturing that, you're taking these environmental portraits, you're capturing people interacting with each other, stuff like that. To be in among it with a, you know, wide to moderate zoom lens, I think renders the shots a bit more personal. And that's another reason why I like that zoom. So I start out the event, when I walk in the door, unless there's something unusual that would override this, I have, you know, the 24-70 on there or equivalent. Like the last event, the Artisan Cheese Festival that I just shot, I used the EM5 Mark II, a mirrorless camera with the Panasonic 12-35 f2.8. That was the lens I walked in the door with. And then most of the time that lens stays on there unless I need to change it for something else. So I just think that if you're going to be serious about event photography, at some point, whether you're shooting Canon, Nikon, Pentax, Panasonic, Sony, whatever your brand is, they all make a lens in this range, and it's something that I think is very useful for event photography. Second item, the optic that I tend to complement the wide to moderate zoom with is a fast portrait lens. Fast portrait lens for me is anywhere between 75 millimeters and 100 millimeters, somewhere in that range. For this last weekend for shooting the event, the lens that I was using was the Olympus 45 millimeter f1.8, which gave me an effective focal length of 90 millimeters. So right in there. With the Canon DSLR, I used to shoot a lot with the 100 millimeter f2.8 macro or the 85 millimeter f1.8 prime lens, which I love both of those lenses. The reason why I like to complement the wide to moderate zoom with this lens, two reasons. One, fast aperture is very important. I need something that's even a little bit faster than my zoom. And I love 1.8 if I can get it, because 1.8, there's a big difference between f1.8 and f2.8 when shooting existing light indoors. And you're going, yeah, the big difference happens to be one f-stop. Yeah, one f-stop is a big deal when you're really kind of pushing the limits of things. Now, the way that I use this lens is when I have to shoot people speaking, when there's something happening up on stage, you know, those sort of things where you need a bit more reach. You need a bit more reach to get to them. The reason why the speed is important, why I wouldn't pull out a 70-200 f4.5 to 5.6, for example, to shoot that, is because usually they're moving also. Usually they're talking, they're gesturing, they're showing something. And so you need to freeze that movement. So you need a fast aperture to let lots of light in, combined with a high ISO to get a shutter speed that's reasonable. You need to get a shutter speed that's up around, you know, 1/200th of a second, 1/250th of a second, if you can, And then at the same time, you're still going to be trying to get the shots where they stop for a second, right? Where they make a point, and then, you know, when they make that point, their hand actually stops for a second, and hopefully their lips stop also. Some people never stop talking. They're very difficult to shoot. You got to take a lot of frames. But like when they make that point, boom, hopefully you can get that, freeze that motion, have a decent shutter speed because of your fast aperture, and get a nice clean shot. So that mild telephoto with a bit of reach and a very fast aperture is very helpful. Now, in certain situations, if you have even more distance to overcome, you're going to have to figure out how to do that. If you need 200 millimeters, for example, to get a decent shot, then, you know, you're in the situation where you're looking at a 70 to 200 f/2.8 or a long prime lens. The problem with that for me is, especially if you're shooting DSLR, now you're starting to get into some weight. You know, the nice thing about the fast prime, for instance, with my Canon DSLR, the 85 f/1.8, it's not a big lens, but it lets a lot of light in and has a decent reach. So when you start getting those big lenses, if you're shooting an event, you're probably going to have to lug it around all day. And I really think hard about how much I'm going to carry, especially if it's going to be an all day and an evening event, because I want to be fresh in the evening. I don't want to be tired. I don't want to be grumpy. And I don't want to get lazy just because I'm worn out from carrying a bunch of gear. So that second lens that I think is essential for practically any event is a nice mild telephoto that's very fast, gives you a little bit more reach, and allows you to freeze movement, especially people talking. Third item, a lightweight flash modifier. So I use fill flash probably about 30% of the time for event photography. I don't use it any more than I have to, and not because I don't like fill flash. I'm actually good with it, and I like the effect when I control it properly. It's because I don't like drawing attention to myself unless absolutely necessary. And of course, a flash does that. It is a beacon. It is like a lighthouse, especially when you're a tall guy like me. I'm literally a lighthouse, right? Boom, boom, boom. What's that guy doing? He's annoying us. We're here, you know, we paid our money to enjoy this event, and he's being a lighthouse over there. So that's the reason why I don't use it unless I have to. But there are times when you have to, and of course, it's okay, and it doesn't bother people. But when I do use it, I'd like to have a flash modifier available to me, especially if I'm in tight shooting portraits. I need to get a little fill light up into their face. There could be strong backlighting or some reason like that. So I tend to use Rogue flash benders for my modifiers. I like them because they're flat. they don't take up any room in my camera bag at all. I can angle the modifier to get what I want. I don't lose too much light with them either. That's another thing I like about them. There's not much light loss. But they just take the edge off the flash just enough to give me a portrait, or if I'm shooting a product or food or something, to give it a nice look without being so harsh like the direct light of your flash. So I have found flash modifiers to be very useful in event photography. Just give you just a hair more control of the light. And that little bit of extra control really pays off when you're delivering the final shot. The fourth item is a battery grip. And man, oh man. Now this one took me a while to come around to the battery grip. And I'm sure part of it is my whole, you know, nimble photographer point of view on things. But I have started using a battery grip the last few years, both for DSLRs and for my mirrorless cameras. And they have saved me. And I'll tell you why. So the nice thing about a battery grip is, of course, it has an extra battery. So you have a battery in the camera, and then you have at least one extra battery, sometimes two, in the grip, depending on what manufacturer makes it and all that stuff. By doing so, then the camera just goes from one battery to the other seamlessly while you're working. And the problem that I was running into before I got the battery grip, before I started using it, is that the first battery would always wear out at the worst time possible. And so then I would actually have to stop, change the battery, and then start shooting again. Now, I could do this fairly quickly. I could do this probably in, 45 seconds, a minute. The problem is a lot of stuff at an event can happen in that time frame. And I actually missed shots that I wanted or shots that were on the shot list because of the situation. Now, in addition to this, there's the whole thing about worrying about when you're going to change the battery or then being having to bring extra batteries because you're being cautious because you don't want to run out, so you're changing them faster than you need to. It just creates a whole distraction that I didn't want to deal with. And the moment I had a battery grip with an extra battery and didn't have to think about that anymore, it really took another, kind of a big thing off my mind. And one thing I've noticed, by the way, for those of you that are thinking about getting the new Olympus, the EM5 Mark II, is that the batteries don't last as long in that camera as they do with the first EM5 or the OMD EM10. The battery life is shorter. I really noticed that on this first event that I used it, that it was, because you sort of have an internal clock. You sort of know when the battery's going to wear out when you've been shooting with the camera for a while. And I usually could get well into the afternoon if I started in the morning with the original battery on my original EM5. And this one starts to peter out around noon. I used two batteries for a full day's shooting and would have another battery in my camera bag just in case I need it. By the way, the other note with mirrorless cameras, a lot of them, if you have a battery grip, you change the battery at the grip and not inside the camera. And so when you do have to do a change, if you do have to go to that third battery, you can do the change much faster. It's much easier. And then finally, almost all battery grips give you another shutter release for the vertical position. They give you additional controls. They feel good in the hand when you are carrying the camera all day. When you're holding the camera all day, it's nice to have, that little extra something to hang on to. And they really don't add that much weight or bulk. So I am thoroughly sold on having a battery grip for event photography, especially shoots that are going to go a whole day or go day into the evening. And my final tip to come away with better shots and have a more enjoyable experience is to have an assistant. And man, oh man, I cannot tell you the value of a second set of hands at the shoot. Things that are important to me having an assistant for, one is managing the shot list. I was thinking about this the other day when I was working the festival. The photography to me is sort of one part of my brain, and the shot list is another part of my brain. And having to go back and forth seemed to pull me out of the zone a bit when I have to manage it myself. Having someone else focus on the shot list allowed me to focus more on the photography, and I just felt like that I had better stretches of good shooting as a result. I could stay in the zone longer. And basically what Leah does, she's the one that's running the shot list on these things. When there's something I need to do, she just grabs me by the arm, pulls me over there, and then I shoot it. And then, of course, we have little check-ins every hour where we look at the shot list, we look at what she's checked off, talk about what I need to do, and then I just go do it. It really helps me be a better photographer by having someone else run the shot list. Second thing an assistant can do is they can be somewhere, allowing you to go somewhere else. And we had this one situation, one of the shots on the shot list was pulling mozzarella. It was one of the classes where they're making mozzarella cheese. And one of the things they do is they actually, while they're making it, they actually pull the mozzarella. And it's a good shot. I can see why it's on the list. But you don't know when they're going to do it exactly. So, and I had five other classes going on at the same time that I had shots to get to. So what I could do is I could park Leah in the mozzarella room with her camera. She could watch things and even shoot it if it started to happen. And then she could send me a text if she wanted me to come over there to something that she wanted me to shoot instead of having her shoot it. And then I could go out and do other things. So it gives you, you know, allows you to cover more than one thing at once. Even if that second person isn't going to be a shooter, they can let you know when it's about to happen so you can get over there. That being said, I recommend that whoever you get as your assistant, and it could be a friend, it could be, you know, a family member, whomever, teach them photography along the way. Because what happens is after a couple of events, they start getting better at event photography. Remember, you're there to set up their camera so they have the right ISO, they have the right white balance, they have the right lens. They have all that stuff. You're teaching them along the way. That's a big part of event photography. You have them set up. You teach them how to shoot it. Then they can shoot it. And I'll tell you, a lot of times they'll come up with shots that really, you know, add to the whole portfolio of the shoot. And one thing that I have Leah shoot a lot on these events is candids. You can't have too many great candids. And they're fun to shoot. Second shooters like it. I say, okay, you know, we're pretty good on the shot list for now. Go off and, you know, get me 30 candids and just have fun. And sometimes those shots just really add a lot. And then there's just someone to commiserate with, to consult with, to bounce ideas off. You know, just having another photographer there or someone who's, you know, part of the project, very helpful. So I'm very high on having a second set of hands with you. And I tell you, I feel like I'm a better photographer when I have an assistant or a helper helping me get those shots. So those are my tips for successful event photography. I hope you find them helpful. All right, next story. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, this is a fun one, okay? This is, I wanted to do something to sort of celebrate Canon's 50 megapixel DSLR monster camera. Because to me, it's so over the top. Now, yes, for landscape photography, yes, for certain professionals doing product photography, this camera is a big deal and they're going to really want it. For a lot of us, though, it's 50 megapixels, many of which we don't need for our everyday shooting. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to come up with five additional things for the rest of us that would help us justify purchasing a 50 megapixel camera? By the way, I think they are selling for $3,600, $3,600, and $3,800, right around in there for those Canon bodies. So if one of these five additional uses catches your fancy, start saving. Here's the first one. Start a business shooting life-size portraits. Huh? Think about it. Think about it. It's funny. All right. All right. Here's another one. Become the first indoor sports photographer that only uses a 50 millimeter lens, right? Because you can crop, right? You've got so many pixels. You can shoot everything with a 50 and then just crop out the part of the frame that you want. And you know, it's fast. It's okay. All right. That was the second one. Third one. Advertise yourself as a billboard photographer by shooting the first 50 megapixel selfie and then putting it on a billboard. Mm-hmm. See? You can tell I'm an entrepreneur here by just listening to these tips. All right, here's one. This one's slightly evil. After the next holiday, send a 50 megapixel RAW file attachment to a family member with a 5-year-old Dell computer with the caption, "Can you believe what Aunt Jenny revealed at the party?" See, that's evil because they won't be able to open it. Okay. I probably don't need to tell you why these are funny, but I'm doing that anyway, just in case. And finally, the fifth reason here. Rent your 50 megapixel camera to other photographers who can't afford one, then use the money to buy stock in 4 terabyte drives. All right, so those are my five additional things to do with a 50 megapixel camera. Let's take a stroll over to the screening room. Today's screening room selection is Black and White Project, Creating a Dramatic Landscape with Lightroom and Photoshop with Chris Orwig. All right, now obviously I have talked about Chris Orwig before because he is one of the main Lightroom guys for lynda.com, and he's also very good with Photoshop. And he started this series of kind of a specialty titles where, you know, he just kind of zooms in on one thing, whether it's portraiture or landscape or whatever. This one caught my eye because black and white landscape is something that I really like. And there's a bit of a knack to it. One of the things that I see when I'm looking at black and white landscape on Flickr and other places that I look at other people's work, I think they sometimes go a little over the top with it. So if I can get a little bit of drama, then even more drama makes it better kind of thing. And the reason why I like Chris's title is he's more balanced in his approach on how to do this. In fact, if you look at what he's doing and how he's doing it, I think your black and white landscape photography will be less over the top, which means ultimately it will have more impact because people won't be looking at it going, whoa, that's intense. They'll be looking at it and go, wow, that's beautiful. So it's one that I recommend you take a look at. It's there at the landing page that we have. We have our own landing page at lynda.com, L-Y-N-D-A, lynda.com/thedigitalstory. The link to the intro for Chris's title is there. And also you can start your free trial there, your 7-day free trial, where not only can you watch the rest of Chris's excellent title, but you can watch all the other stuff. There's like over 3,000 titles at lynda.com. I have a bunch of them, and Chris has a bunch of them too. But today's selection is Black and White Project, Creating a Dramatic Landscape with Lightroom and Photoshop with Chris Orwig. It's a good one. Let's take care of a little virtual camera club business. I'm going to start out with sizzle pics today. I was looking at the calendar and I noticed that we have Mother's Day coming up, Father's Day coming up, graduations coming up. There's a lot of stuff we're coming into that time of year. And if you're thinking about an excellent gift for any of those special days, then now's the time to be putting it together, especially if it's going to be something based on your work, where you want to do something special. You want to present a meaningful photograph to really commemorate the occasion. And what better way to present that photograph than as a sizzle pics? What you do, what you create, what you give is going to last a long time right off the bat. So that's kind of neat. You're not just giving a gift for right now. You're giving a gift for decades up the road. Second of all, it's stunning. It's beautiful. So there's that part of it, right? That's always a nice thing. And then I think the third part is it's a bit unusual. A lot of people have never received a metal print. And so it's special in that sense. They go, this is amazing. I've never had one of these before. And of course, you can hang it right on the wall right away. Now's the time to start thinking about that sort of stuff. SIZZLPIX.com. It's like a retina display you can hang on the wall, and they have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. Also, I want to mention the good folks over at Red River Paper. Their Facebook page is at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And that is the place to hang out to watch for what's going on in the world of printing. By the way, the new Epson P600 is available now. It's a printer that I don't see a lot of people talking about, but it's a beauty. And I got to test it a bit when I was at Photo Plus last year. It's a 13-inch printer. Fantastic for black and white photography. Fantastic for color photography. I mean, this printer is really nice, and it's relatively affordable for a professional / enthusiast printer. And if you really want to get into black and white photography, like I was talking about with Chris Orwig's title, you know, once you get that image, that quality black and white image on your computer, the next step is to make a print. I mean, that's when you really realize the project from start to finish. And Red River Paper has so many excellent stocks for black and white photography. And they have tutorials about printing black and white, paper surfaces, all that stuff. It's all over at the Red River Paper website. And you can get there by our landing page. All you have to do is click on the tile on any of the pages of the digital store. You take you over to our landing page. You can get the discount code and you can explore from there and really see that black and white project through. Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the digital story. All right. Well, I think that is going to do it for me this week. It's interesting doing it in the morning. It's different. I really do. I mean, I'm basically a writer in the morning and a talker in the afternoon. That's generally the way I work. I don't know if you notice any difference or not having me do the podcast in the morning. Anyway, I guarantee whatever you think of today's podcast, it would be better than me doing it either after the Warriors game last night, which would be around midnight. Believe me, you did not want that. That's like the late night FM DJ podcast. Or me rushing out the door before the Warriors game. So I think this is the best option. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you come back next week. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.